Sunday evening, and that can only mean one thing in the voice of Barbados. That means it's time for another edition of the Better Health Radio Show. And this evening, we've got Dr. Kia Lewis on deck for you, and she is going to join us with her guests to bring you another scintillating program. So let's say a very special evening to Dr. Lewis.
Hi, good evening, Gregson.
There we go.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I've been better, I can tell you. I've been better.
How are you doing?
I've been better. I seem to be tackling some sinus. But anyhow, we can hear you now. Go ahead.
Thanks. Good. Glad to hear that. I wanted to say a warm good evening to our listeners here on the Better Health Radio Show, a show which is aimed at raising public awareness of common health issues that affect us all. Let me also say a happy Easter, happy Resurrection Sunday, however you choose to put it. I can't go without saying that. All of you. And as usual, it's my absolute pleasure to host you this evening. We have a very exciting show coming up for you. It's a topical issue. I'm sure that you will be interested in what we have to say this evening. As always, we look forward to your engagement. And so we want to take the opportunity to remind you that you can contact us with your questions and comments, either by calling us at 434-1790. That's 434-1790. Or you can send us a WhatsApp message at 266-4862. 266-4862. Let me remind you, the program is not the same without you. So please do take the opportunity to call in. Now, this evening, we are going to be dealing with what I said, an interesting topic. We're going to be looking at the issue of elder abuse. We've heard so much about the QEH and how many older persons are left there abandoned by their families. And we often hear a lot in private practice about issues at nursing homes and even issues at people's private homes with older people being abused. And so this is not a topic that we can ever talk too much about. In fact, I think we need to talk a little bit more about it. That said, we always have our experts in for you. We try to get the best of the best, people who know about the topic. And so this evening, we have a lawyer, attorney at law, Ms. Kimberly Benjamin, and we also have Dr. Adrian Charles, who's having a little bit of an issue joining us, connecting with us, but we are hopeful that we can get him on soon. So we'll work on that while we chat with Ms. Benjamin. But let me tell you a little bit about Ms. Benjamin so you can see why we specially handpicked her for this session this evening. Ms. Benjamin is an attorney at law who was called to the bar in 2020. She holds a master's in legislative drafting from the University of the West Indies, CAFIL, and a master's in national and global health law from Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. Kimberly has worked on various short-term consultancy projects with the Caribbean Court of Justice, the Academy for Law, the PAHO, World Health Organization. She's also worked with Healthy Coalition, and she has served. Kimberly is a member of the Barbados, and importantly, I think this is probably the most important piece for me. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, Kimberly and a small team of volunteers were regularly visiting senior citizens' homes to spend time and meaningfully engage with the residents. Commendable. She's passionate about human rights and the use of law to address health issues in the Caribbean, such as non-communicable diseases and, you guessed it, elder abuse. Her aim is to be influential in filling existing policy and legislative gaps and in developing new policies and laws which address the rights of the most vulnerable, notably children and older adults. Welcome, Kimberly.
Thank you, Dr. Lewis, and good evening to the listeners. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me on this evening's program.
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to introduce Dr. Charles in his absence. I'm hoping that we're able to get him on. But I'll just tell you a little bit about him. Dr. Adrian Charles, he's well qualified to speak on this topic as he started in psychiatry. And in this field, he would have encountered many cases of elder abuse and had to deal with them. He also went on to general practice, and he's worked extensively in elder care in the public geriatric system. And so in his absence, we welcome Dr. Charles. We're really hoping that we can have him on. So Kimberly, I'm going to start with you. I want to ask the obvious question. We're speaking of elder abuse. Let me start by saying, what made you interested in the prevention of elder abuse?
I'll start first, Dr. Lewis, by just acknowledging, as you said, it is an interesting topic, but it's also a difficult one. It's not one that persons like to talk a lot about it, but as you said in your introduction, it's one that we need to talk about a lot more. And my heart definitely goes out to those who've been affected by this directly or indirectly and in the prevention of elder abuse, because it was definitely the bad experience had by my grandmother in a senior citizen home in Barbados. I'm talking about broken limb, bed sores, those kinds of issues in homes that are meant to really look after older adults. And so it was through hearing another attorney based in the US, he's an American, criminal defense attorney, talk at this leadership summit. It's called the Global Leadership Summit, about getting proximate to people that you want to assist. And her experience made me want to get proximate to older persons because, as we often say, they're often placed in vulnerable situations where they cannot always advocate for themselves. And so I felt like it was something I could do even before I became an attorney. So I decided, in terms of me getting proximate, that meant spending time with the older adults. And so it saw me going into a senior home and engaging with the older adults in conversation. At first, this was a one-man show. Well, really, a two-person show, because I brought my mom alongside with me. And so we were going into the homes and just talking to them, getting to know them. And then eventually, a group of students who also attended the Global Leadership Summit decided this was something they wanted to be part of. And so before I knew it, it had expanded to a team of volunteers going into the home on Saturdays and just spending a couple of hours with the older adults in that home. Another part of the initiative was report writing. However, that part, again, I found persons were not willing to always file a formal report. They wanted to talk through the issue, but when it came to taking specific action, they were a little hesitant. And there are a number of reasons for that. Some obviously fear victimization, retaliation. There's a feeling that the reporting process itself is just worthless. It's just going to be another document on someone's desk. And so there were challenges with the reporting aspect, but definitely getting into the homes and getting proximate to older adults was an important part of my journey and helped to really stimulate my interest in this topic of preventing elder abuse. So I think as well, because of Barbados's aging population, when you really think about it, Barbados has one of the largest percentages of persons who are older, over the age of 60. We're talking about 11% being over the age of 65 in recent statistics. And so it's a topic too that's not just for those who have been directly impacted by it, like myself, but you know, it's something that we shouldn't wait till it comes at our doorstep or affects our loved ones. So that's how I got involved in it.
I agree with you, Kimberly. And you know, we are always more passionate about topics when there's a personal backstory behind it. So when people hear you speaking this evening, they know that you're not just talking from an intellectual standpoint, but that you have a vested interest in the area of elder abuse. So I'm going to follow on with the question, because we always like to start here with definitions. I want to ask, is there perhaps a legal definition of elder abuse? What are we talking about when we say elder abuse?
Yes, I agree. It's always good to start with definitions because it helps to just put things into context. Barbados does not actually have its own legal definition of elder abuse. We don't currently have any laws or regulations that specifically deal directly with the issue of elder abuse. But Barbados, being a member of the World Health Organization through ratification of the World Health Organization's constitution, we can take hold of the WHO's definition for elder abuse. And that definition really talks about it being either a single or repeated act. It talks about it also potentially being a lack of appropriate action, so an omission, and that those acts or omissions occur within a relationship where there's this expectation of trust. Mm-hmm. And those acts and omissions then cause harm or distress to the older adult. And so this definition has a lot of different points to unpack. I would say first and foremost that we're talking here about older adults. So again, within the context of different jurisdictions, who is considered an older adult may differ. Usually though, it's persons over the age of 60 years. Mm-hmm. But again, that can vary by jurisdiction. The WHO definition that we just looked at covers both actions and omissions, and that's important. So it's not just a positive action, but it's also an omission. And then the definition talks about abuse. And we know that there are different types of abuse. So there may be physical abuse, so inflicting pain on an individual, physical force being used on an individual. We know that there's also sexual abuse. So this is where there's non-consensual sexual contact with an older adult. We know also there's emotional or what's called psychological abuse. There's also financial and material abuse. But then under that broad abuse category, we can also talk about abandonment. Dr. Lewis, in your introduction too, you mentioned the issue of persons leaving older adults at QH. That's abandonment, neglect. Mm-hmm. We can also talk about self-neglect under the broad umbrella as well. And so the definition of abuse is a good starting point, but a lot to unpack there. When the definition as well talks about the expectation of trust, this is really getting at the fact that the older adult usually knows the person who is abusing them. So it's sometimes often a family member, persons in institutional facilities, and so on. But I wanted to draw the listener's attention as well to another definition. This one is found in the Inter-American Convention on Protecting the Human Rights of Older Persons, which deals with the fact that it's not just in relationships of trust. So the definition actually has whether or not it occurs in a relationship of trust. And I think that's an important extension to the World Health Organization's definition, in the sense that it captures more persons who could potentially be abusing older adults in society.
Right. So I think you've given us a very, very comprehensive picture of elder abuse. And I like the fact that you talked about omission and actual action, because sometimes we only look at the actions, but we don't look at the omissions. So that's really important. We have a caller, Gregston. Do we still have that caller?
Yeah, good evening.
Welcome, good caller.
Evening.
Actually, I wrote a poem on the differently able, but I wouldn't do that now. I wanted to spend 6 weeks in the hospital, not really in a home of itself, but I spent 6 weeks in the hospital, and I find that the younger nurses, especially those pretty faced ones, they don't really look after the disabled, especially if they cannot help themselves, and they feel that they should be supervised by someone, you know, that is more elderly than them. Because I had some experiences in there in my 6 weeks that, you know, if I had not for God help, I don't know what would happen. But the first thing they wanted to know, you're stone, you know, or maybe they find out that, they're not just for that, you know. So I find that they need to be supervised, these younger nurses that work in the senior homes, you know, in the hospital of itself. Not just leave on their own. Not, there's some exceptions to the rules, but mostly the majority of pretty faces, ladies, they are just there for the money. And that is the truth. You know, they are just there for the money. And I tell you, I have my experiences, so I know what I'm talking about.
All right, caller, let me give you an opportunity to turn your radio down, because if you don't do that, you'll hear that noise coming back at us all the time, and it will irritate somebody. So I don't want them to get irritated, so you got to turn your radio down, and for anybody else who's calling in, you must do that prior to calling in, because we'll get the same effect if you keep your radio up. And I'll give the good doctor and her guest a chance to respond.
So I just want to say thank you to the caller. I know there are lots of No, there's a lot of public discourse surrounding the QBH. So I really do want to say that, you know, we are sorry for the experience that you would have had. We know that there, in any profession, there will be people who are there to do it and do it with excellence. And then you will have those who might not execute it in the way that we would like. So we do acknowledge what you have said. And, you know, like we said, this is something, elder abuse is something that needs to be addressed throughout the system, private, public, wherever you go. We do need to address this issue. So thank you for your contribution this evening.
Okay, Doc, go ahead, please. In fact, now that I have your attention, I probably should stay with this and say a very good evening to our next caller. Good evening.
Yes, a very good evening, Gregson. How are you, sir?
I've been better, trust me, but thank you for calling. The doctor can hear you, please. Go right ahead.
Oh, Lord, sorry for that. Well, you know, all of my grace comes from you.
Oh, really? Sinus is kicking up, so let's not bother, but nonetheless, go ahead.
Well, I thank God for you, nevertheless, you're on the right show, and I'm sure the good doctors can give you a great solution to your problem.
I'm quite sure they can.
I do continue to be my source of grace at this time. You know, the church celebrates this time as a time of glorious grace, so, well, my grace comes from you.
You're too kind.
No, I mean it comes from you, so continue to be the source. And I thank you, and I really appreciate you, and I do hope you feel better very soon.
Thank you, sir.
I have two questions tonight. Dr. Lewis, good evening, and good evening to the panel. Thank the production team for taking my call. My first question is, what happens in a case where the person to which the topic we're discussing tonight, the elders, have a chronic illness? They're suffering from different or multiple illnesses of different levels, and they want to die. In other words, the status is that they're basically having a status quo of euthanasia. That is their character. That is what they want to do. But the younger person, like me, wouldn't want them to do that because I want to see my grandmother or my great-grandmother live as long as possible, or I want to see her suffer, whatever. You know, the kind of sadistic human types today in the narcissism that we face in terms of mental health. And coming out of COVID, this would have been one of the good questions that I would ask, because there would have been a lot of elders that would have been doing nothing during that time, and they would wish to die, they would wish to expire. So I'm just asking, what about if a younger person like me wants to keep the person alive, but they, as in terms of euthanasia, want to die? Is that a case of elder abuse? And I have another question when I finish.
All right, so what I will do, this is, I think, both a medical and a legal question. Dr. Charles has joined us. Dr. Charles, welcome to the program. Dr. Charles?
Good evening to all.
A warm welcome. We've already introduced our audience to you. And so I believe you would have heard the question that would have been posed. So I want to give you the opportunity to get your input in there, and then I'll pass it over to Kimberly to give the legal framework.
Well, I would say first of all, I'm going to refrain from making a comment on the legal, but I would say the first thing that has to happen, even in countries where there is legal support for it, is that you have to ascertain that the person is in a mental state that they can make that decision. So sometimes the person is speaking from a position of sadness or pain. They may be in chronic pain. They may be suffering. They may be suffering for things like depression, anxiety. So when the person says, "Oh, you know, I just want to end it. I just want to die," the first thing is to really find out what is happening, and that search for information should include a thorough medical evaluation, both in terms of the person's general physical state and of their mental state, to see if they're suffering from conditions that may be causing them to say that, even though it wouldn't be their actual position if they weren't suffering. I have absolutely come across this before with elder people who said, you know, this is it. I just want to die now. And what was happening is that they were in terrible physical suffering. And when that suffering was alleviated, they no longer said that they wanted to die. Mm-hmm. So that's my medical position. But I'm sure the lawyer would have things to say as well.
Okay, I think that's an excellent point, or a number of excellent points, I would say. Kimberly, what's your take on this?
Yeah, so I just want to thank Nicola for the question as well. It's an interesting one because within the Barbadian context, we don't have those laws which facilitate those kinds of decisions. So in other jurisdictions, there are instances where there are living wills, for example, or advanced directives where persons can make those decisions whilst they are fully capable. So as Dr. Charles mentioned, where they have soundness of mind, they can make those decisions. They can include them in specific legal instruments which provide for end of life care decisions. In Barbados, we don't have those kinds of provisions. So it is not a case where that will be possible in Barbados. I would add as well, the caller specifically asks whether his action, because he doesn't want his loved one to do that, whether not taking action will be considered abuse. And I just wanted to bring the caller's attention back to that definition of elder abuse and to say that, you know, it's really the action or omission, yes, but which causes harm or distress. So you telling this individual making them aware of the laws of Barbados would not constitute abuse. However, of course, if you take action and actually assist that person, then you are causing harm or distress to the older person. So I would say that from the legal perspective in Barbados, there isn't the provision to do that. In other jurisdictions, yes, there are mechanisms by which persons can make those kind of end-of-life care decisions and include them in legal instruments.
Thank you very much. Excellent. Beautiful. Wonderful. That is brilliant.
Hold on, caller. Go ahead, Dr. Charles.
So I would just want to add in terms of the topic of elder abuse, that the reaction you have to the patient, to the person, is important. So although you'd have the legal response that, you know, there are no laws permitting that. But if you then respond and say, well, you're too stupid, you know, if you respond and say negative things about the person, if you respond in a way that is hurtful to the person, that could be considered abusive, right? So, and one of the difficulties that we have is that within our culture, we've normalized a number of kind of belittling and disrespectful behaviors when people say things in pain. And those reactions that may seem like nothing in the moment and may even not be painful to someone who is in a good position and strong and healthy, when the person is weak, when the person is in pain, when the person is dependent, when the person is reaching out for vulnerability, yes, some of these dismissive responses can be very painful and can constitute abuse.
Okay, caller, second question.
Yes, thank you very much indeed. I really appreciate you all answering my question, and I'm fully comprehensively covered. Now, this next question is a little more interesting. It's a little trickier as well in terms of, I just mentioned comprehensively covered. Now, we're dealing with insurance here. Now, coming out of a pandemic like this where I would have mentioned that they didn't have a lot to do, you know, they would have been bored. The mental illness comes into play here, especially with the great, silent really pandemic of dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and so on that the elders get. Sorry for this, but... Based on the type of, Ms. Kimberly there would have said that the lawyer that there is really no legal legislation toward it. In terms of the making policy and insurance policies as well, how would elders benefit in terms of these modifications to the lifestyles that we live today based on the fact that they would have been they would have been born a long time ago. They would have been through the world wars. They would have been through all the pandemics and so on. But they've survived, but they're not in a good mental state. How can we better use the legislative aspect of and the insurance aspect as well, those policies, those draftings of underwriting and so on, and the policies of government in terms of Parliament and the Senate? What can we do to make a sound choice for them, even when they can't make a sound choice for themselves based on those two parts of our society in terms of its social arm toward the elders. Thank you. Goodbye.
All right. So, Kimberly, is your caller still there?
No, he said goodbye. So
he's okay. So he's gone. So, Kimberly, I gather from what I'm hearing, he's asking about the legal framework for persons who are not capable of making decisions on their own. And I know there's a medical aspect of that, which Dr. Charles would have spoken to. Dr. Charles, I don't know if you want to comment on the process of determining when a person is no longer able to make decisions on their own. And then, Kimberly, maybe you can speak to the legislative protections that are in place for people.
The question of when someone is has capacity, mm-hmm. is there's a medical aspect and there's a legal aspect. The medical aspect is, I'm going to say, it's flexible in the sense that someone can have limited capacity in some ways, but can still have capacity in other ways. Someone can have mental impairment. Someone can have the early stages of dementia, but if they satisfy certain criteria, they can still be deemed able to make certain decisions. And that assessment is best made by a medical practitioner with expertise and training in making that determination, usually a psychiatrist or a geriatrician. There's a medical assessment and then there's a legal aspect to it as well.
And I think that, Dr. Charles, what you're saying there is very important, because people assume that once there's an impairment in one issue, in one area, I should say, that person should not be allowed to make any decisions. And that's absolutely incorrect. This is something that should be medically determined in most cases. And it really is a consultative process. So I really want to point that out to our listeners this evening. Kimberly, I'm going to hand over to you.
Yeah, that's really important. The medical evidence, because armed with that, then the individual can approach the High Court seek an application to appoint a receiver for that individual who is having the issues with their mental capacity. So that would really be the legal avenue. And I think at this point too, is important to just clarify something to the Barbadian public, because I've heard this a lot, people talking about powers of attorney and seeking to use them in this way. But it's important to recognize too, from the legal perspective, that that particular legal instrument, when the person becomes of unsound mind, that instrument ends, it terminates. And so it can't be used in that regard. But the proper procedure would be to approach the court for the appointment of a receiver who would then be able to look after the affairs of the individual, of the older adult, and will be kind of under the jurisdiction of the court.
Kimberly, I want to emphasize that point, because I know we use some language there that everybody might not be able to understand, but I want to make it clear to people the issue of power of attorney, like you said, is misunderstood. So, Ms. Benjamin, if I'm correct, what you're saying is that as long as the person, so somebody can make you power of attorney, but they have to be able to make that decision, right? So they have to be of sound mind, capable of making decisions. And as long as they're no longer capable of making decisions, you can no longer continue to be their power of attorney. That's correct. Yes?
Yeah. So the instrument, the power of attorney, is mm-hmm. really the action on one part. The person is normally called a donor. So the person mm-hmm. given the power and the person receiving that power to act on the individual's behalf in the conduct of his affairs and so on is the donee. So what happens is that both the donor and the donee must be of sound mind in this transaction. Mm-hmm. And if either one becomes of unsound mind, that instrument should not be used any longer. There's, and that's very important, because I hear a lot of people talking about using the powers of attorney and so on and doing these things, but it's not the proper procedure. In fact, it shouldn't be used in that way, because the donee, if a donee acts knowing that the person who has given them the power to act is of unsound mind, they can be legally liable for whatever actions they take on using that power. So that's very important. Like I said, the proper procedure would be to approach the court for the appointment of a receiver.
Okay, thank you so much for expanding on that. I think that makes it a lot clearer for our listeners. Dr. Charles.
Before you move on, Dr. Lewis, I beg your pardon. We have another caller for you. Do you wish to engage?
Oh, sure. Of course, always.
Yes, please. Go right ahead, ma'am.
Peace be on you.
Good evening. Welcome, caller.
Hello?
Hello? Hi, good evening. Welcome.
Peace be on to each and everyone. A blessed Easter to each and every one of you. Thank you, Jesus. I'm glad you brought up about the power attorney, because I've heard so many cases where families and even the same person that made the person power attorney was treated very bad. So I'm glad, and I guess you must not just let this one, because a lot of people might not be home. You know, this is Easter season and people are at church and things like that. You must come back again with this same power of attorney so that others would hear. But what I call for is about, you know, I've heard on several occasions, read and watch, that families were, you know, persons were gravely ill and they were told that nothing can be done and pull the plug. But I don't believe in that. I don't believe in that, and there's something I am going to speak for myself. I don't want to be cremated. So I don't like that. I have someone that is very close to me, and I'm not doing so well because they have stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and I just hope that the family don't think about doing that, because I'd be very devastated. Let them go on their own. Mm-hmm. That is my thing. I ain't like pulling the plug. You know, people say, oh, the doctor said, well, there's nothing more that they can do. So this thing, I don't believe in that. Mm-hmm. Like, they should die mm-hmm. on their own. Thank you all very much, and a very wonderful program. Thanks to VOB and the persons who bring this about, because we are learning more and more and getting more information of a lot of things, especially when it comes to heaven. I'm glad that you brought in lawyers and those kind of things too, so that we would know what is going on. It's only just about our illness, but then about certain things we have to do in our families that cause a lot of confusion and enemies. Thank you very much. Have a blessed week, and God bless Barbados. Bless you all too.
Thank you so much, Carla, for your contribution. I know it sounds like you're going through a very difficult time. You know, I really pray that, you know, you will find comfort and strength as you battle through this particular issue. Thanks for your contribution this evening. Dr. Charles, while you were attempting to log on, I know that Ms. Benjamin would have done a good job at breaking down the types of elder abuse, but I wanted to ask you, what are some of the signs of elder abuse that persons might look for, especially for persons who are visiting their older relatives, whether it be in an institutionalized setting or there's another relative taking care of them? What are some signs of elder abuse?
That is an excellent question, but with your forgiveness, before I tackle that, I actually would like to just briefly address something that the caller said about people pulling the plug on elders.
Oh, yeah, sure, of course.
And the difficulty there, of course, is that every medical treatment has its potential benefits and its potential risks. So the difficulty that one faces quite often is that doctors can make a professional assessment that the risks facing the patient with a particular treatment, based on their age, frailty, other diseases, and so forth, are so great that the risks and negative characteristics of the treatment vastly outweigh the likely benefit. You know, and that's, as the caller was saying, that can be a very difficult thing. You know, we all, you know, hope springs eternal in the human breast. You know, the ancient writings. And we all want to have hope, but we all have to be very careful that the treatment we undertake is in the best interests of the patient and not in service of our own desires and hopes and wishes. And that is a difficult thing. We've faced it with our own families, many of us. We've faced it with our patients. So I don't want to make it seem like it's a small thing, mm-hmm. But it's not just a matter of people kind of pulling the plug or giving up where it shouldn't be. It's a situation where you face a very difficult situation where the risks and negative aspects of the treatment outweigh, vastly outweigh the likely potential benefit.
Yeah. Sometimes it can really be seen as an act of mercy, you know? Maybe
you want
persons to be here with us, but sometimes the suffering really is a lot, you know? So there's that perspective.
I remember a study was done where they said that they interviewed a number of elderly people with certain diagnoses, and sort of palliative care, where you're not looking to engage in certain cures anymore, but you're looking to maintain function and maintain comfort and engagement with life as long as possible without trying for cures at that point. The more the person knew about certain diseases, the more likely they were to accept the validity of palliation. You know, so you have a situation where the senior nurses, the oncologists, the cancer doctors, and so forth, who had certain diagnoses, were more likely to say, you know something, I know with this diagnosis, cure is not really what I should be aiming for. You know, so quite often you can take leadership from people who've had certain sorts of training, but at a certain point, your goals have to reflect the likeliness of the various outcomes.
Indeed, indeed.
But right, so in terms of addressing the question, the whole issue of what of signs of abuse. So this is a very painful thing. But first of all, you know, the various categories of elder abuse. So for physical elder abuse, which is obvious, often the most obvious, because the person will often have injuries. Sometimes broken bones, sometimes obvious internal injuries. There's a question as to how could they have gotten this, bruises, scratches. Sometimes the actual injuries would point to a particular inappropriate kind of physical contact. So I've seen slap marks on a person's face or grip marks on their limbs. I know it's possible to have grip marks absent abuse, huh? But then when you investigate, the story you were given doesn't match the physical injuries. Or there's something called immersion or a scald lines, where you can see where the person's limb or body part was pushed underwater. And then they have a scald matching a particular pattern of abusive interaction. Now, emotional abuse, which is one of the more common forms of abuse, the most, depending on where the measurement was done. In some places, financial abuse is more common. In some places, emotional abuse is more common. I would say overall emotional abuse is probably more common generally. And when you see an elder who seems obviously afraid of a particular caregiver, that's a red flag. Or feeling unwilling to talk freely in front of them, where every time their attention shifts, they're a little more willing to talk. But from the time they look at the patient is silenced or ceases that line of conversation. The other thing to look out for is, you know, quite often families are very hesitant to put a transfer to elder care, but usually when you visit the person, you can see they're doing okay. You know, they might not be totally happy at being there, but you can see they're looking relatively well. But when someone is transferred and you see them immediately sort of losing weight, looking disheveled, looking dirty and so forth, you have to ask questions as to what is happening. It may not be outright abuse, but it should be enough to make you ask questions. And then financial elder abuse, unexplained transactions, disappearing valuables, checks cashed under uncertain circumstances. Same thing again, where the story doesn't necessarily match the things that you're seeing. A situation where the elder is saying that they can't access financial records, and the person who has them is not somebody who's really authorized, you know. A neighbor has their documents. And a situation where you have newly signed documents where the patient is not really capable of signing anything, checks, powers of attorney. Now, again, sometimes you have inappropriate things done by appropriate people in good faith. You know, they take the wrong route. But sometimes the people doing this are people who really shouldn't be doing it. You know, it's a relative that appeared out of nowhere who would not be the next of kin, or even somebody in the community who's not a relative. So those are signs of financial abuse to look out for. And last but not, well, I should mention signs of sexual abuse, which is Less common, but I've seen a few cases. Injuries to or around genitals, scratches, bruises, signs of penetration. New sexually transmitted infections. Sometimes elders will have subtle sexual infections. They've had an infection for years, has never been diagnosed. But sometimes it is obvious that they've gotten something recently with no history of sexual contact. But, you know, we shouldn't make assumptions, because I've known of cases where when you speak to the elder, they're very able to tell you about perhaps questionable, but not necessarily abusive sexual contact they've had with another elder. So you have to ask questions and investigate. And last but not least, in terms of the signs of sexual abuse, sometimes you will actually see flirtatious or inappropriate behavior from a caregiver, where they're making physical contact in ways that are questionable, or they're making references to the person's private parts or so forth in ways that are inappropriate for the supposed relationship. Which brings us to caregiver red flags. The flirtatious and inappropriate physical contact would certainly be a caregiver red flag. Other caregiver red flags would be caregiver unwillingness to leave patients with the healthcare staff or with other family members. Isolating behaviors where the person doesn't want the patient to speak to family members or friends, especially people who they've had a long-standing relationship with, neighbors, friends in the community and so forth, who go to visit, and all of a sudden they're not allowed to speak to the person.
Mm-hmm.
Or we've had situations where there's a regular phone call the elder would have, and all of a sudden as they talk about what is happening at home, the phone call has to end, you know? Or sometimes caregiver anger or indifference. You can see, you know, you can, when they talk to or at the person, you can see this anger that seems odd, or an indifference to what is happening with them. So those are some of the red flags to look out for, and some of the signs of abuse. And that's as long as that list was, it's a partial list. And this is a difficult thing. I'm going to say that elder abuse is broadly understudied, underdiagnosed. All the numbers and figures we have are gross underestimations.
Yes.
Because for every case that is registered and documented, there are 10, 15, 20, 40, 50 cases that we try to deal with them, but never make formal kind of measurement or declaration. You know, the person is quietly transferred to the care of another caregiver, you know, and it is never registered as a formal situation. I would say the ones that are registered formally tend to be the ones that are unusually flagrant. So that's my contribution in response to that question.
You know, Dr. Charles, I was listening to you. Excellent response. And I was thinking to myself, there must be somebody out there sitting going, oh my goodness, you know, things going off in their head. You know, they have had a suspicion, just a feeling, an uneasiness. But no, I believe that you're probably highlighting some major red flags for people out there. And I want to encourage listeners, where you see red flags, don't ignore it. You know, seek to investigate, seek to ask questions. I'm not saying go and call the police, you know, because like Dr. Charles would have pointed out, some of the things, you know, are not as they appear. But certainly don't let it go unchecked. Don't let the stones go unturned, you know, giving persons the benefit of the doubt. So I'm really hoping that this information helps somebody to uncover, you know, what might be a dangerous situation for an older relative. Now, we're having this discussion because it's very important. And I don't like to have discussions just about the problem, but I like to delve into solutions as well. So, Ms. Benjamin, I'm going to ask you, what laws and policies do you think can be used to address the issues surrounding elder abuse, elder neglect, elder exploitation in Barbados?
Thank you. Just to tack on a little bit to what Dr. Lewis and yourself were saying, if you see something, say something. That's a saying that I hear often when I travel. You know, it's one of those taglines that make sense in the context of elder abuse. In terms of the laws and policies, really and truly what we need in Barbados is a comprehensive piece of legislation which addresses elder abuse directly. But in the absence of that, to answer your question, there are different laws in Barbados that could be used in their current state. They're not as robust, obviously, as we would like to for the protection of older adults, but can be used. I think first, starting with the Constitution of Barbados, I know it's currently in the process of, we're going through the process as a nation of constitutional reform to get to arrive at our Republican Constitution. But even in what we currently have, our Constitution, there are rights and freedoms that would extend to the older adult. So the right to property, the right to protection from inhumane treatment, the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, all of those are fundamental human rights, which would directly apply to the older adult. I would say as well, it's interesting because the different grounds in the Constitution actually does not include age as one. So, you know, we're talking about the new Constitution, and that would be something that I would love to see included to really afford them the protection. Other laws that could be used, our Offenses Against the Person Act is another one. That one deals broadly with assaults and murder and attempted murder. Hopefully, we would be able to stop the abuse before it gets to that point. But, you know, that is definitely an avenue that can be used by individuals who are experiencing that nature of activity. There's also the Sexual Offenses Act. Dr. Charles was talking about the different signs, and definitely the Sexual Offenses Act will cover things like rape of an older adult, indecent assault. And so that piece of legislation could also be very useful for an individual who's experiencing that particular conduct. When it comes to financial abuse, which Dr. Charles also mentioned, we can think about the Theft Act of Barbados. Because that would, you know, apply broadly to all individuals in Barbados and including the older adult. Because if a person is dishonestly seeking to appropriate the property of an older adult, it definitely will come under the Theft Act as well. In terms of physical abuse, again, we can think also about our Domestic Violence Protections Orders Act. And this act has some amendments to it as well, which, even though elder abuse is not specifically called out in that legislation, for example, that act speaks specifically to child abuse. There's a definition of what it means. There's also a reporting violation, sorry, for not reporting child abuse. So when I started out earlier talking about us having comprehensive legislation, it's things like these where there are gaps, even though there are laws that could help us in Barbados to tackle elder abuse, there are gaps in them. So this Domestic Violence Protection Orders Act, even though it could be used, it could be more robust to really protect elder abuse. It could provide a definition of elder abuse, for example. But even without that, the older adult will fall within the definition of who's a dependent. Potentially, sorry, could fall within the definition of who's a dependent under that piece of legislation are those who would be considered to be in a domestic relationship. So, of course, that would not cover, though, the older adults who are in institutional facilities where, you know, they're not in that kind of relationship and so on. I talked about the Mental Health Act earlier in terms of the appointment of receivers. So that's another piece of legislation which could be used to help protect older adults. In the context of COVID too, I was thinking recently, you know, a lot of activities have been moved online. How can we protect older adults who have been forced as well to go online? It could be with their banking services, just online transactions, trying to pay bills and so on. And again, the legislation in Barbados doesn't specifically address the older adult, but we can think about our Computer Misuse Act. We could think about the Data Protection Act, which was in the news a lot recently, and different pieces of legislation which could help to protect the older adults. But if you take away anything from that, my answer just now to the question, it would be that we need to do better in terms of more robust in terms of a robust piece of legislation that genuinely protects the older adult. Because, you know, we're always here in Barbados is this aging society. We have to do more.
Yeah, so thank you so much for that answer. What I gather is that there are lots of different aspects, but like you said, we need to do more to have a comprehensive piece of legislation. But I want you though to speak to, you know, the ordinary Barbadian out there who might be aging and thinking ahead, how can I protect myself? What are some things that I can put in place? We encourage people to make a will, but the will covers after death. I know in some jurisdictions there are advanced health care directives, you have living wills, enduring powers of attorney, things like that. But first of all, are those instruments useful in preventing abuse, neglect, and exploitation? Do they apply to our jurisdiction? And if not, what are things that older Barbadians, the average everyday person, can do to protect themselves legally?
That's a good question. It's a difficult one. Though the instruments you mentioned, and I would have spoken earlier about the advanced health directives and the living wills and so on, those do not apply in our jurisdiction in Barbados. But those instruments are useful in terms of allowing older adults to plan ahead and to even plan when they are no longer able to do so. In our jurisdiction, we don't have those instruments in operation. So, those are things that we can begin to talk about as a nation, talk about how we can include similar instruments or include, the potential for older adults to use such instruments to protect themselves. We talked a little bit earlier about the powers of attorney. That is one way, especially if the older adult maintains the soundness of their mind. Mm-hmm. It's one way that the older adult can, give another the authority to act on their behalf. I would say in that regard, though, that there are different types of powers that can be given. So there's a general power and there's a specific power. And even within those categories, you can have time-bound provisions, and so that the power could be for a specific time. So in terms of protecting oneself, I would say definitely for the older adult to consult with an attorney, to talk through what it is that they're concerned about, talk through what it is, their assets, what it is that they're hoping to really protect, have that conversation with an attorney, have a consultation with an attorney who would be able to advise you on the best way forward. Obviously here, I'm just giving kind of a general perspective, but each person's case will differ. I would say that with the power of attorney, depending on the individual, having a specific power of attorney, which deals with specific actions or activities that the donee can do on behalf of the donor, so the person given the power, that is helpful because it provides a limit as to the authority that is given. So, the person who has received the power cannot just go off on a tangent and do whatever they feel like on behalf of the older adult. You know, the specific power of attorney will have exactly laid out what it is that the individual can do. In addition, I would say for those who are of unsound mind, it is that appointment of a receiver, like I mentioned earlier, under the Mental Health Act. So that's an application to the court. And there as well, the evidence that Dr. Charles was mentioning earlier, the medical evidence and so on will become useful. And that receiver really then will be the individual who is empowered to look after the person's affairs. So again, it's the court would, of course, review the evidence and so on to ensure that the individual is of unsound mind and that this person being appointed as the receiver is, fit for that role. And that is another thing that older adults can look to. But again, it's really, for me, it's really about having that robust legislation with key provisions that would prevent this discussion from even happening. If we have legislation where the penalties are high enough, where persons are aware of the fact that they will come under the strong arm of the law if they abuse elders or older adults, then we wouldn't even be having this conversation today.
I just want to point out to our, sorry, Dr. Charles, you wanted to add to that?
I did.
Sure.
And I found that very educational, but I have a different perspective to add. There are a number of risk factors that have been identified from a healthcare perspective. Mm-hmm. We know that abuse is strongly correlated with geographic and social isolation, is correlated with certain patterns of dependence, especially a situation where you have an elderly, unwell person who is dependent on a single caregiver, where that single caregiver is then dependent financially on the elderly person. That's a particular pattern that leads to abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Because you then have a situation where this caregiver then feels resentful and so forth, particularly if the caregiver is already stressed and overburdened, particularly if the caregiver has substance abuse issues with alcohol, or especially with alcohol, but other substances as well, cocaine or whatever, especially where the caregiver has a history of violence, criminal activity, but violence including violence towards children.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, and there's another specific pattern specific to men, where older men enter into particular kinds of transactional relationships with people who they're saying, yes, I have this young girl who's going to take care of me and I'm going to enjoy this relationship. And those things can shift to relationships of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of protecting yourself, those are then factors to look at in terms of protecting yourself, where you avoid isolation, you avoid social isolation, you maintain your contacts. If you know you're in a house with a caregiver, you make sure you maintain relationships with people who are coming to visit you and so forth as much as possible, where you avoid certain patterns of dependence. You want to choose caregivers who are not totally dependent on you, which is counterintuitive. Many elderly people like the idea of a caregiver who's dependent on them because they feel like it gives them control. But while it gives them a certain amount of control, it also fosters resentment and increases the risk of certain kinds of abuse. You want to avoid caregivers. And again, these are things that paradoxically many elder people like. They like the idea of kind of rescuing someone who is in the throes of dependence and so forth. And they think, well, if I get them, they're going to be so grateful to me that they will do whatever I want. And that can be true. But again, you're also stoking resentment and building a situation that can be high risk, and that can deteriorate. Avoid caregivers who are already overburdened. If you know, even if it's your favorite child, if you've got a favorite child who already has three young children taken care of and whatever else, you know, when they're coming to you exhausted at the end of a 12-hour day to wrestle with you and your adult diapers, you know, you're putting them in a situation where everybody's at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And older men and the transactional relationships with young women who they don't know well. And this is not all older men, and this is not all trans. This is not all of these relationships, but you have to be careful and aware of risk. I've known of multiple situations where you know, the men choose caregivers with kind of lascivious ideas in mind, you know, and then enter happily into isolation, thinking they're going to be able to use the isolation to get certain things. And then it ends up that they're putting themselves into a situation of abuse. And this has been well described in the literature, that this is a pattern that particularly men are
vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are a number of things that from the outside, the legal framework that was so ably described, that we can watch out for, both in terms of protecting ourselves as we get older and watching out in terms of our loved ones, you know. So those are some risk factors and some potential points of action that I would draw to the public's attention.
I think those are all excellent points, both Ms. Benjamin and Dr. Charles, because what I'm gathering is you have to put the two together. So you do want to seek legal advice. Yeah. While you're in your right mind, you want to sit with a lawyer, discuss your assets, discuss your care, what are my options? And then you want to look at your social situation. And I think this is a family discussion as well. You know, who's going to be responsible for my care? You know, look out for those red flags, persons that might not be the best option, even though intuitively, like you said, Dr. Charles, you might be led towards that person. So I think it's really important. And the point I want to make to our listeners from all of this is that you have to begin to plan. Or as you get older, you really have to think about who's going to take care of me. What are the best options? Legally, what are my options? You have to begin to think about it and have these discussions.
Okay, Dr. Lewis. Yes, before you go quickly, just two comments here that I want you to address if you can before you disappear, because time is upon us. This person is saying, looking after elders with dementia can be emotionally exhausting. So in terms of solutions, what is being done to give family caregivers the emotional and other support that they desperately need?
Okay, you said that that was one. Is there a second one as well?
Yeah, the second one is off topic, but it made me smile when I saw it.
Oh, well, let me deal with the one on topic. Yes, let me deal with the one on topic first. So I'm going to open the floor to either Dr. Charles or Ms. Benjamin. I want to say here too, Dr. Charles, if you could tell us about some ways that people can seek help, not only for support in taking care of their relatives, but also in support if they recognize signs of elder abuse. If you could give us just some quick tips on both, that would be great as we wrap up.
Okay, certainly. Well, in terms of help, the first thing I would say is to echo what you said earlier in terms of planning. So as you realize that a person, whether it's yourself or there's a family member, is going to need care, planning ahead and trying to put things in place from early is really essential. If you realize that somebody is showing signs of dementia, don't wait until the family is having difficulty coping before you start looking to start sort of make plans either for private nursing care or for institutional care. You should really plan for institutional care before you want it or need it.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you want it and need it, it may not be immediately available.
Right.
So the difficulty I see is that families, you know, you don't want to put granny in institutional care necessarily, but you got to start planning before you want it and before you think it is necessary. Because mm-hmm. then when you want it and the stuff you can afford, there's a year-long or 18-month waiting list, you know, the families can end up in desperate situations. And in terms of what to do when there's suspicion, when you come across something. And I came across a five-point plan or a five-point approach where the first thing is to seek information, ask questions, whether you're asking from neighbors, talking to other family members, and of course, talking to the person who you think is abused. Even if they have cognitive impairment, once they can talk, and even if you don't think they can talk, still ask them a question because they can surprise you. When you come and you say, good morning, and whatever else, sometimes people who you didn't know could talk will tell you what is happening. And when they talk, listen to them, validate their feelings, even if you don't think that what they're saying sounds too credible. Even mm-hmm. if you don't know what to actually do about it, you can tell them that sounds really difficult, that sounds really scary, that sounds like a difficult thing to have to deal with. And I want you to know I am here. We're going to try to get to the bottom of this. We're going to try and find out what is happening. I'm going to do what I can to try to make sure you are comfortable and you feel safe. Validate them and reassure them that you will, that you're their partner and you will do what you can. And again, you don't have to agree with everything they're saying, right? Because sometimes the account you get is not quite accurate, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I've come across situations where people even say that they're being abused, but accuse the wrong person because the person that is really doing the abuse is somebody who they're terrified of alienating, you know? So it can be complicated and you don't want to jump to conclusions, but you can always validate the person's feelings. And then point three, you got to, even if you're not trained, you got to do some sort of assessment of the threat and urgency level. And there are certain basic common sense things. Obviously, if the person seems to have broken bones, obviously, if the situation is where you have a caregiver who's glowering with rage, and you know, there's some situations that obviously the danger seems to be urgent and you may need to call emergency services, right? So that's the, you know, safety is paramount. Don't just kind of leave the person in a situation that feels dangerous because you don't know what mm-hmm. to do. When in doubt, call the emergency services. I would have to say that. But in response to outright danger.
Right.
And then once you've determined that, you know, I don't think this person is about to have anything calamitous happen, but I just got some questions, recruit professional assistance. And I am biased, but in my view, the first step would be healthcare assessment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether the a doctor, sometimes community nurses can be involved. And You can do that in ways that are tactful, depending on the situation. You know, you can say, well, this person got this thing. I don't think the doctor's seen this yet. When are we going to carry for a doctor to see this here? Or I don't know if they told you, but they got this pain. And you can kind of try to influence the situation in favor of getting healthcare assessment. And then through healthcare, there are then next steps in terms of social worker assessment, mental health assessment. There are various ways that can branch off into deeper multidisciplinary assessment of what the situation is. So then the professionals can try to bring assistance on board, you know, to remedy the situation.
Right.
And last but not least, no matter who you are, if you're getting involved in doing things, take notes. You may be asked about it later. You know, you don't want a situation where a doctor or the social worker is asking you questions and you don't know whether the person said it is Timothy or whether the person said it is Matthew that mm-hmm. did something to them. You know, so take your little notes, even if you're not a professional, so that all the details, because the other thing is, in the heat of a situation, details can escape you and details can be lost. You know, so try to make sure that when you are then telling somebody later on, that all the details are there, nicely written down to jog your memory, and so you don't get anything mixed up. And that's the 5 points: seek information, listen and validate feelings, think about safety and urgency level, seek professional help. Generally through healthcare is what I would advise, but that's me with my bias, and keep a record so that when you're asked questions later on, you have all your information at your fingertips. And that 5-point plan, the good thing about it is it applies to everybody. It actually applies to professionals as well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So but it also applies to people in the community, to lay people out there. Seek information, listen and validate feelings, think about safety, seek help from multidisciplinary help, and keep a record. And that's it. That's what to do.
Thank you so much, Dr. Charles. That's very, very useful.
All right.
I know that you're well spent.
Yeah, well spent. Well past our time, but I want to get this one very quickly. Alleviate the fears of this WhatsApp here, please. They say, good evening, Gretchen. Before the program is finished, could you please ask the good doctor, how accurate is the blood pressure app on the cell phone? Thank you. So could you help the person, please? Is it accurate or not? In your opinion,
very inaccurate.
Very inaccurate.
Very inaccurate.
Very inaccurate.
Yes, that's what I thought.
So measuring blood pressure requires an actual apparatus. You know, the phones can do certain things, but measuring blood pressure without an apparatus that goes around your arm or your wrist or whatever else, measuring blood pressure is not one of them. So okay. Very, very inaccurate. And if you look at the fine print, they'll generally say it's for entertainment purposes only.
Yeah, and the one around the arm is also more accurate typically than the one around the wrist. That's some like Tame patients. So no, we don't use cell phones for measuring blood pressure.
Okay, so there you go.
Just to put that out there, Miss Benjamin, I just want to give you a quick few seconds because you were so gracious to be on the show with us. Just a closing comments, and then Gregson, I'll hand over to you. I may get some lashes for this, but go ahead.
No problem. Go ahead, please.
Tacking on to what the caller was asking about being emotionally exhausted because they're dealing with a loved one who has dementia. I've been there. Obviously, our situations may be different, but I would say having a team around you who can support you is important. I know that in our Barbados National Policy on Aging, there's talk of education and training of caregivers, and that would be something I would love to see, but also seeing that specifically targeted to persons who are living with dementia, so caregiving of such individuals, because it's completely different from an older adult who may just have a physical ailment. Dementia brings a whole set of new challenges into the household, especially if the person is remaining at home. You can't leave them in the house depending on the stage of dementia they're at, and so mm-hmm. many, many challenges. But I would say where you can, if you have support, reach out, ask others to help you so that you're not doing it alone. It's not a legal answer. It's important.
I'm so sorry. I just want to cut in to completely support what she's saying. But again, reach out to medical, start the plan to try to get the person in care. Private nursing may be possible for some. We do have a community outreach system for assistance with elder care through the polyclinics, although it's not as much as I would like, but it exists. So help is out there, and also pull together the other family members so it's not just one person. So yes, and that's my response to that. Thank you so much, Ms. Benjamin, for picking that out, because that's an aspect we should have responded to.
All right. So Dr. Charles, Ms. Benjamin, I want to say thank you. You guys have provided a wealth of knowledge, another excellent show for our listeners this evening. It is clear to me, we've not gotten through half of our points. It is clear to me that we are going to need a part two. So I'm really hoping to have both of you back on the program, you know, for more insight into the area of elder abuse. And I think that we need to have a topic on just caregivers, you know, just providing support for caregivers and the different mechanisms that exist to help them cope, whether it be caring for an elderly person or a disabled person, or, you know, there's a lot of caregiver burnout, and that in itself can lead to abuse. So I think we have to have a separate program on that altogether. That said, I want to thank you, listeners, for being with us this evening. Thank you for your calls, your questions. Thank you, Gregson, for offering excellent support as always. And I want to wish you a safe, enjoy the rest of your weekend. Do it safely, no excesses. You know, just get some rest. And we are looking forward to having you join us next week for another Better Health program.
Yes, please. Thank you so kindly, Dr. Lewis. I'm being entertained by our next program presenter here. But anyhow, I want to thank you, Dr. Lewis, for being the host of this program. Your guests, Dr. Adrian Charles and attorney Kimberly Benjamin, so kind of you to come by and share your knowledge with us. Next week, we look forward to either Dr. Lewis or Dr. Do You Have an Idea? As I usually ask you.
It's always a surprise, Greg.
Someone will be here.
Stay tuned. Pin to your seat.
Thank you, Kylie. Have yourselves a good afternoon. Good evening, rather. It's almost 7:15. So you take care, and we'll catch up next weekend, God's willing. All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.